If both were to compare CUFDM relative to HBSB in different reception conditions, to go beyond what had been done previously, to look at outdoor, indoor, and portable reception, that being a particular new kind of service that is at least garnering some interest among broadcasters and others. And then secondly, there would have been, if the phase one goals of the comparison of COFDM and HBSB had warranted it, more investigation of COFDM to look at all the ifs, ands, and buts and details of exactly how would you do that, how would you run HBSB in parallel with COFDM, how would you transition over to COFDM, how would you deal with legacy receivers, all those things. It, in fact, was not considered warranted. So I'm going to talk about what's in the document called the HBSB COFDM Comparison Report. Many of you probably have it. If you don't have it, it is available for downloading on the ATSC website. It turns out they had the manpower available to make big PDF files out of this rather large report with a lot of appendices. So if you're really interested in it, you can get it off the ATSC, www.atsc.org website. This was started in the spring of 2000. It was supposed to be a six-month time frame, but certainly the phase one effort, which was the comparison, was always intended to be finished in the year 2000, urgency of timing being a very important business consideration, political consideration, and for the people involved in the technical side of this, it was important to them too. The basic game plan was to go beyond what other field test programs had done and do it in a comparative mode, to make sure we tested multiple stations on different channels in different antenna configurations, to test in different environments, different cities, to test the different receiving conditions, and especially to make sure that we had the best comparison that we could put together in the time frame vis-a-vis the best receivers, both for the COFDM and HVSB side, that were available at the time that the tests were taking place. There were a lot of outside contracts involved in overall project management of this program. The COFDM equipment was all characterized, both on the transmit and the receive side, before it was used to make the decisions about what to use. And those tests were done up in Canada, in Ottawa, at the Communications Research Center. The ATTC in Alexandria, Virginia, did the parallel testing for all the HVSB equipment. And Dennis Wallace and his crew, who have done more DTV field testing than anyone else around, had the overall management of the field test contract. But we also had a consulting engineering group, Cavell, Mertz, and Davis, to kind of look at an oversight mode of all the aspects of the test program, and we actually bid that out to other consulting groups to see who would be most interested and best equipped to do that. The other side of this comparison project was to do a coverage and interference study, a paper study, a computer study, to see what the impact of switching to COFDM would have on the allocation table, on the coverage and interference of each of the stations in the U.S. And to do that, you have to characterize what the various desired to undesired ratios of both HVSB and COFDM receivers would be. And we did that work in the Zenith laboratory facility. Zenith didn't do the work, but they offered their facilities. And we populated it with Cavell, Mertz, and Davis people and some volunteer broadcasters, and did those studies there, and then used the results of those service characterizations to run coverage and interference computer studies to see what would the impact be on overall DTV service and for interference into NTSC, and I'll show you those results as well. So who, what, when, where? This was the DVB-T flavor of COFDM. We were not able to use to access the ISDB equipment, the Japanese version, although we wanted to, but the equipment simply wasn't available. And of course, that was tested against the ATSC system. These were field tests and comparative spectrum analysis. They're separate and distinct from each other, but of course, both are of great interest. The actual testing took place in the summer and the fall in Cleveland. I guess you couldn't call mid-December the fall because it was snowing, at least part of the time. The field tests were in the Washington-Baltimore area. We had stations both in Washington and Baltimore and in the Cleveland area. The basic test plan was to find out which of these two digital modulation schemes was better. It was not meant to be a overall, that you could look at the ATSC side and take the percentage of service and say, that's how good digital television is. We went to places we knew would be tough. If we had done this in Wichita, Kansas, I think, you know, we wouldn't have learned anything except that flat areas receive digital television really well at long distances. So there was a lot of pre-biasing of the testing to try and expose differences when the going got tough. The other thing that we did in Cleveland that we did not do in Washington was to compare digital television with NTSC. We couldn't really do that in Washington and Baltimore, at least couldn't do it and look at ourselves in a mirror because we did not have co-located NTSC facilities. And if we did, they weren't on the same channel. And if they were on the same channel, they weren't at the same height. And if they were at the same height, well, they weren't related in the proper power ratios to be able to do service comparisons. We could do that in Cleveland because Cleveland, the station we use, is a very unique situation of being on channel 2 and channel 3 for their paired DTV NTSC assignments. So you actually use a common antenna. Obviously, they're at the same place. The powers are adjusted to do replication as best as possible. And so in Cleveland, we did do actual test or comparative testing of DTV and NTSC. These are the stations used in Washington and Baltimore, WUSA, WETA, the public station in Washington, WRC and WBAL. You can see from the numbers there, these are UHF stations that kind of span the UHF dial. Some of them are very high power, up to 800 kilowatts, down to 75 kilowatts at WETA. And so we also have the paired NTSC channels there, although we did not report measurements on NTSC service. And as I said, in Cleveland, we used the channel 2, channel 3 combination at WKYC. Since that's paired, that's why they, of course, have the very low 7 kilowatts of DTV power, although they're at a pretty high level. Just throw in some pictures at WETA, the DTV transmitter, the VSB modulator and the COFDM modulator. We used, of course, the same transmitter and then switched the exciters to emit either COFDM or 8VSB at the same average power. As far as the measurement sites go, in Washington we had ARCs that were 40 miles away from D.C. and 30 miles away from Baltimore, so they kind of crisscross and give you an interesting cross-section of sites to measure. We had 8 grids in one cluster that were relatively close in, and also extended radials that went, 6 extended radials that went out from distances starting at 45 miles, every 5 miles out to 55 miles to see in fringe area performance which of these systems was more robust. Then in the indoor program, we had 45 homes, actually convinced 45 people to let us into their house and track mud and then clean it up. So all in all, about 250 sites, 200 outside and about 50 indoors. In Cleveland, again, a couple of ARCs, one 25 miles away, one 50 miles away. This is VHF, remember. The two grids were very close in, about 9 miles from the transmitter. And then three radials that went out to 60 miles from the transmitter. And about 25 indoor sites for about 125 sites total. We did the standard 30-foot outdoor measurements, as most people, as the FCC has done and others have done for many years. And then people started scratching their heads and saying, "Well, with this digital stuff, you can really get in trouble if you're not going to use that." So we also did indoor antennas that were measured inside, as well as a 6-foot outdoor antenna. This was a dipole. At least in the case of UHF, a dipole antenna, to try and mimic portable reception such as it might be on a a laptop kind of TV, or if you think more futuristically and aggressively about personal digital assistant kind of pedestrian devices. So that was our reason for our 6-foot outdoor antenna that was stationary, though. We did not test mobile reception because, guess what, 8VSB doesn't work in a mobile mode. Everybody knows that. And so there was no comparative mode to do that in. The way we got so much data in such a little time was to multiply the number of receiving installations. We had 4 different trucks, all identically outfitted, donated by either CBS, ABC, MSTV, or Dennis Wallace's truck. And so they were able to collect a lot of data in a parallel fashion and really build up a database rather quickly. Inside one of the trucks, it was cramped, but certainly there was room enough for the receivers and the common display we were using to show whether you had pictures or not. On the receive antennas, the outdoor antenna, we used a typical directional log periodic antenna. We used a typical VHF-UHF antenna combination in Cleveland, where, of course, we had to receive VHF, so it was a bigger antenna. The indoor antenna in Washington, we used 2. We used a bow tie, and we also used the so-called silver sensor set-top antenna that has gotten a lot of, maybe not accolades, but a lot of good things have been said about the silver sensor antenna for UHF reception. And in Cleveland, we used the MegaWave set-top antenna. MegaWave is a little company making antennas. Actually, NAB threw some seed money into MegaWave years ago to develop a better indoor antenna, and eventually they did. It's a very low volume unit, but it is what we used for indoor testing in, and also for the 6-foot testing in Cleveland. So the portable testing, the 6-foot testing, half-wave dipole for the Washington and Baltimore stations, and the MegaWave set-top antenna for the VHF station in Cleveland. Typical testing scenario, you orient the antenna, start with 8VSB, orient the antenna to get best reception. There was a particular procedure for doing that as to whether it would be maximum signal or maximum tilt or a combination of the two. Measurements were recorded. The margin was measured, adding noise in the truck until you hit threshold. And then we did something else, was to rotate the antenna and as long as it held signal lock, you keep rotating it and document it so that we could document for each station the maximum angular displacement you could go through on an antenna. This was our ease of reception figure of merit to see if there was a difference between the two systems overall in ease of reception. And then you switch the transmitters to COFDM, the same average power level, and repeat the procedure. We tried as much as we could to make this an apples-to-apples comparison, so-called, but of course we were not really dealing with the same kind of fruit here. This is the DVB system versus the ATSC system. The COFDM, if you look at the pertinent parameters, it's 64 QAM on each carrier, 8K FFT, forward error correction of 3/4, a guard interval of 75 microseconds, and it gives you a net data rate when you put all those things together of 19.76 megabits per second, which compares well with, but it is not identical to, of course, the VSB system, which has a higher FEC, the equalizer range of the receiver we were using, greater than 40, but not much greater than 40 microseconds. And the net data rate, of course, of ATSC, 19.39 megabits per second. So apples to apples, yeah, maybe they were different kind of apples, but it was certainly comparable in the attempt to equalize out the data rate and so forth. I'll go through the spectrum analysis first. This was what I mentioned, the computer study, to figure out if you switched every transmitter to COFDM, kept the same average power, kept the same frequency, what would happen to coverage and interference in the existing FCC channel assignment plan. And so we had to do laboratory tests of COFDM receivers to see what kind of ratios of interference they could stand before they failed, and what their impact of COFDM on NTSC on an adjacent channel would be, and so forth. And out of that, you obtain a matrix of planning factors, just like the FCC planning factors, except for COFDM and new planning factors for 8VSB. And then using a computer model, we compared the two. So I'm going to give you the results of everything we did, starting with the selection of equipment for field testing. Now, there was a lot of instant replay quarterbacking on some of the equipment we chose after the fact, but we actually had what we thought was a very good way to select equipment and pick the best equipment, and that's what we did. So we used a laboratory both to select the equipment for field testing and to get these input parameters for the planning factors study and the spectrum analysis. And then I'll talk about the field test. So I'll do that actually in that order. The COFDM equipment, we went out to all the people that make COFDM equipment, went to a dozen manufacturers, of course none of which are based in the United States, to acquire COFDM receivers that could work in a 6 megahertz environment. 3 manufacturers came back to us and said, yes, we can, either we have equipment that does that or we'll modify it to do that, and we'll try to work with you. We had 6 different criteria for selecting which was the best modulator and the best receiver. We did all those tests, as I said previously, at CRC in Canada. Turns out of the 3 we tested, 2 of them really could not have been used in a field test. One, because its first adjacent channel rejection just wouldn't last a minute in the U.S. environment, might last a minute in places where all adjacent channels are co-located, such as some countries in Europe, but in the U.S., it really wasn't usable. And the other one that was disqualified had a very poor dynamic range. It did not like strong signals, and we didn't think it was fair to use a receiver that really wasn't practical to put in the real RF environment, which after all was what we were testing, real RF environment with real equipment. So we ended up with the other receiver, which actually in all other categories performed the best anyway, so that worked out well. 8VSB receiver testing, manufacturers were not that willing initially to participate in this program. They saw it as a threat, not an opportunity. They did not want to really see this program go forward initially, but those challenges were overcome. We went out to 14 different manufacturers. 4 manufacturers came back to us to have their equipment tested. Again, we had 6 criteria for selecting the best receiver. We did the tests at ATTC in Alexandria, and we found that 3 of the 4 receivers we tested had some limited performance, some problem in them in one of the 6 criteria, but they were not showstopper kinds of problems. We could have used any of those 4 receivers in this test program and had a valid comparison. We did, however, of course, pick the best one of the 4 for the field test program and went forward that way. Well, when we took those receivers and we did the spectrum analysis, this is the 100,000-foot view of what happens when you substitute COFDM for 8VSB. And you have to differentiate whether the impact is on population, since the computer program counts people, but it also counts square miles. And, in fact, the population would suffer by almost 6%, whereas the service area hit was closer to 14%. We also found very interestingly that COFDM would cause minimal interference to the existing NTSC service, which seems perhaps a little counterintuitive because COFDM is a more aggressive interferer, but because of the way channels are allocated, you don't find that happening very, very often on adjacent channels, for instance, where many assignments in the U.S. are adjacent channels co-located, and the difference in performance never comes up because they're all well within the margin of rejecting the adjacent channel. So COFDM wouldn't kill your NTSC service pretty much at all, not measurably, but the digital service would suffer, at least in that order of magnitude. Little chart to go a little bit deeper into that. There's more of this in the report, but if you the way to read this this chart is the on the left. These are on the right, the percentage of stations that are affected, meaning that, you know, pick a line here, 31% of stations would suffer 5 to 10% loss of service area by going to COFDM. 38% of stations by population, or I'm sorry, 38% of stations would suffer a 0 to 5% decrease in served population by going to COFDM. So you can see most of them are in the below 15% category, but there are stations out there, especially on the by area side. You can see 23% of stations would suffer 15 to 20% area loss. So if you're in an area of high growth that isn't yet being populated by people, you might worry about something like that. But you can go into that kind of analysis and see where the losses would be. Washington-Baltimore results, got charts and graphs for you, both for the outdoor stuff, the indoor stuff, the portable reception stuff. I told you where the sites were. These are actually where they were. That's Washington right in here and Baltimore up here. So you can see the two arcs. Here's the 30-mile arc from Baltimore, the 40-mile arc from Washington. And grids and so forth are closer in. So those are where the actual site measurements were done. The findings overall, give the results, the overall results first from the conclusions part of the report. At 30 feet, 8 VSB was successfully received at a greater percentage of sites than COFDM on all four stations, and 8 VSB performed better up to the farthest distances measured, which were up to 55 miles. But at 6 feet, COFDM was successfully received at a greater percentage of sites than, that should say, 8 VSB. For close-in sites, but at greater distances, the performance was very close between the two systems. And in the ease of reception testing, which this was this antenna rotation thing, COFDM generally outperformed 8VSB at 6 feet. So, give you some of the charts and graphs here. When you look at the different stations, so this is the overall successful reception for WBAL. Red is 8VSB. Blue is COFDM. So you can see on WBAL, WRC, WSA, and WETA, now this is all at 30 feet outdoors, and then if you combine all those together, you have 75% reception for 8VSB and 48% for COFDM. If you go down to 6 feet, you find that it kind of reverses itself, or it seems to reverse itself, and it actually does reverse itself, but the COFDM reception really doesn't change very much. If I go back to the previous slide, watch the blue slides, they don't go down anywhere near as much as the red ones do. So we had a big drop in 8VSB reception going from 30 feet to 6 feet, but not much of a drop on COFDM, which seemed to stay centered more or less in this 40 to 50% category, the overall being now 36% compared to 42% at 6 feet. Here's one station showing the reception as you go farther and farther out from the transmitter. So this was WRC and at 30 feet, and you can see that the effective distance on COFDM having a higher threshold for successful, about a 4 dB difference at that data rate for threshold, you can see that the COFDM reception drops off as you get out to 30 miles and 40 and 50 miles from the transmitter, whereas the 8VSB performance stayed relatively constant throughout the as you go to farther and farther distances. And that seemed to be a trend that was in the data. That really wasn't so much true in the 6 foot category. Well, I guess it's still true. You had 70% in 10 miles and less for COFDM, and that goes down quite precipitously down to the 20% region or even below for COFDM. whereas the 8VSB really wasn't good in the first place, and it pretty much stayed that way. So signal level was not the problem for 8VSB. It was a problem for COFDM. This chart, and there are lots of these in the report, show the ease of reception kind of thing. Across the x-axis here is each one of these is a station, and the red chart here shows the angle of rotation that you achieved for that station. So for 8VSB, there were only, let's say, 15 stations where you could rotate the antenna something close to 360 degrees without losing the signal. And then it kind of dropped down here to 180 degrees, and a lot of stations could do that, and then, of course, it dropped off. The COFDM, though, for those stations where you had reception, many of them could be rotated. The intensity of angle of the antenna was very apparent. You could move the antenna all the way around for quite a few more sites, and then it dropped down and dropped off, as did the 8VSB one. So there are charts that will show that. Indoors, we found the percentage of successful reception was rather similar between the two systems, and it was rather similar regardless of which indoor antenna we used. Problem was that successful reception was only down in the 30% range, which no matter which system is being tested, is not exactly the stuff that a successful service is going to be founded on. So these are the individual stations. Again, this is all Washington and Baltimore. You can see WBAL, pretty horrible performance. But remember, we're measuring indoor sites largely in Washington. So again, a bias of the study is we're pretty far away from Baltimore to be not only getting the station, but getting it at a low antenna height and a brick wall away from the transmitters. But even at the Washington station, and of course the Washington stations too are trying to get Washington stations in some of the indoor Baltimore sites. There are many more Washington indoor sites, but we did have Baltimore sites. But all those things tend to drive down the percentages. No matter what, though, the clear trend is that they're rather similar. Overall, 30%, 27%. Not very good overall, but not a big difference. And that was the bow tie antenna. This was the silver sensor antenna. I'll go back to the previous chart. That's bow tie. That's silver sensor. Not a revolution happening there. Now, Cleveland results. And this was taken from the truck in the last week of testing, where they were real happy that it was the last week of testing because it was a snowstorm there. Again, we did 30-foot stuff, we did indoor stuff, and portable tests as well. These are the sites here. Remember I told you we had radios that went out to 60 miles, again, going farther than the UHF test because of the VHF propagation characteristics. You can see the arc, one of the arcs, the 50-mile arc here, and you can see the 25-mile arc. And the city grids were downtown. At 30 feet, 8VSB was received at a greater percentage of sites than COFDM. It performed better than COFDM when you were away from the transmitter, but when you were closer to the transmitter, COFDM performed better. So kind of a mixed result. And for sites that had NTSC picture quality that was considered acceptable, where we had the crew do CCIR subjective measurements and pick a grade, well, they measured on the 5-point CCIR scale. So where you had acceptable NTSC picture quality, where that means CCIR grade 3 or better, 8VSB was successful at those sites 92% of the time, whereas at those same sites, COFDM was successful 78% of the time. So that's kind of the replication test. And at 6 feet, 8VSB did much better than COFDM. However, it didn't do very well generally, 28% success rate, which was not very good. So 30 feet, again, these are all sites taken together on the left here, 73% versus 60%. These were the arcs. These are the grids. Notice on the grids how much better COFDM did, again, close in. And on the radials, 8VSB did much better than COFDM. When you look at the 6 feet results, COFDM only showed up to play really on the grids at the 25 and 50 mile arcs. No reception, virtually no reception on the radials, and so you get the overall statistics that are on the left. Indoors, successful reception for 8VSB, 9 percentage points better than COFDM, but 8VSB, again, down at a very low percentage rate, 26%. So if you look at, we made three measurements for indoor measurements. We made a measurement in the driveway at 30 feet, so this is an outside measurement, at the sites, and there, COFDM and 8VSB, very comparable to each other. Then we took a measurement down at 6 feet, but still in the driveway, or, you know, driveway area, and the 8VSB reception went down, but the COFDM reception really dropped off the cliff pretty much at that point. And indoors, whereas COFDM performance was about the same indoor and outdoor, we had another drop for 8VSB. So that's the indoor statistic that I said, not the 9 percentage point difference, 26 to 17, but 26%, again, nothing to get excited about. We did find that overall the data confirmed the theoretical carrier-to-noise performance difference at using the parameters we had for COFDM in equilibrating the data rates. Performance difference of about 4 dB of advantage of 8VSB versus COFDM, and that effect was quite evident in the farther we got from the transmitter or in the indoor environment. Level matters. There's no question about it. Yeah, fine. We negotiated a lot of words that said things like both technologies had areas where their performance characteristics could be improved, and the performance deficiencies of both systems accounted for some of the failures observed in the field. In other words, these receivers were not perfect. They were, and unequivocally, they were the best in class that could have been tested at that time, but they certainly had problems with them. We did some failure analysis. You can have failures because you don't have enough signal. You can have noise. Impulse noise was certainly an issue at low VHF in Cleveland. Interference, of course, and multipath, one place where theoretically 8VSB and COFDM are differentiated, and the receiver characteristics all can be contributory to failure. Well, here's one failure analysis, is if you look at the sites where you did not get reception and look at how many of those didn't exceed the minimum carrier-to-noise ratio you needed, you find that overall 55% of the failures in COFDM never had a chance because they never got over the carrier-to-noise threshold needed to achieve reception. So if you didn't get over the 19 dB you needed in an otherwise perfect environment, you don't have a chance of receiving the signal. So that was true in 55% of the cases of COFDM, but 8VSB having a lower carrier-to-noise threshold of 15.3 dB, we only had 40% of our failures that fell into that class. So that was certainly a contributory effect. The confusing slide that no one understands, but this was the adjacent channel performance of the COFDM receiver, which had a quirk in it. It had an anomaly, which we called the receiver anomaly, in there. And you can see you would expect that as you go to adjacent channels that are where the interferer is NTSC and you're trying to pick up DTV, you would expect the farther away you get from the channel of interest that the rejection of the receiver would either stay the same or get better. So you would expect to see, this is the DTU ratio needed, and you would expect to see that kind of go down on this chart. And it does when you're on the high side of adjacent channels being rejected by the DTV receiver on channel N. But that wasn't true on lower adjacent channels, which was kind of funny. So N minus 1, about 25 dB DTU ratio, N minus 2, minus 40-something D to U ratio. But then when you come up to N minus 3 and N minus 4, it jumps back up to minus 25. We queried the manufacturer on this. We tried to explain it. We did the test over again. We couldn't explain why that happened. It only happened when NTSC was the interferer. When COFDM was the interferer into the COFDM receiver, we could get DDU ratios that stayed up around 40 dB, which is the, well, it's not, this is only NTSC and the DTV. So it was specific, something about the NTSC carrier, specific to the low side of the adjacent channel rejection characteristics of the receiver, that probably accounted for some failures in the field. It certainly isn't a general reason why we had failures in the field, but certainly had something to do with it. Similarly, the difference in echo range of the COFDM receiver being 75 microseconds versus 40 microseconds for the APSB receiver, probably some effect in a few cases there as well. Overall conclusions were, HVSB is suitable for a broadcast service when you're at 30 feet outdoors. The results were less optimistic for outdoor reception at 6 feet for both systems. Neither system exhibited the level of reliability required for an indoor broadcast service. And we felt that the VHF performance was so bad that this idea of using very low power levels for VHF in the FCC rules and planning factors, man-made noise level is probably higher than anyone thinks, and that there ought to be some rethinking of the planning factors at VHF as a result. But we don't have a lot of data. We only have the data that we had. A lot of people worked on this, obviously, and that's the end of the technical presentation. As you may know, ATSC has gotten involved in all of the improvements of their own standard now, and they released a report just a few days ago, which is on their website, big 73-page report called Performance of Assessment of HVSB, and they go into a lot of the deficiencies that were exposed in this study and work done by others and point out what the theoretical limits might be and point out what the practical implementation issues are from a system point of view, and it's a really good technical document, and I'd recommend it to you. They may have copies here if you go over to the DTV store exhibit, which is in the grand lobby where ATSC is at. They can tell you more about that report. As I said, this report is available at least on the web, a lot of other work is going into HVSB improvements. So I thank you very much. I'd be glad to take questions if there's time.
Hi, Gregory Ford of PBS. Comment that difficult sites were chosen for site selection, and it is true that there were some Baltimore testing done for DC transmissions and vice versa. By and large, we would go to, my involvement as a technician on the project leads me to believe that it was mostly random. We would go to our radial or grid or what have you, find the dot on the map for outdoors and go to the nearest crest or open area and set up there. So we were actually trying to find the optimal site selection close to the dot on the map. As far as indoors go, again, we weren't searching for difficult sites. It was just whoever would let us into their house, as you know. And then we would set up near their viewing area that they already had in the house and probably go right up to the window to get good reception once there. So my comment is that, yeah, I agree that you can't analyze the performance of either system based on these tests because they're meant to compare each other. And because you did have exceptions where you're comparing a Baltimore site for DC stations, et cetera. But we didn't seek out specifically difficult sites by and large. Thank you.
Just respond briefly that, you know, a lot, of course, was known about the Washington area previous to this test, the 1998 test done by the model station and MSTV and other tests done in Washington. So some of the radials and so forth were picked with pre-knowledge of that, as well as the indoor sites. My house, for instance, had been used in previous programs, was not used in this test because it was known to be a place where you didn't where you didn't get indoor reception. So that's actually an anti-pre-bias. Don't go to Claudia's house, it isn't going to work. So that technique with understanding the environment from a scientific point of view, very different than saying, let's make a grid of the Washington area, take 1,000 locations, and then have a computer randomly select 200 of those sites. We didn't do that. So the selections were done with generally with knowledge of the area, the terrain, and previous field test results. So I think it's a mix of, it wasn't only go to the most challenging sites. Let's look at all the terrain profiles and only look where there's obstruction. But not as a scientific study. This certainly wasn't a random selection of sites, nor was it random with respect to how many were within 10 miles or 20 miles or 50 miles. Only a few were, it was very, very much biased towards being closer in, depending on how you define closer in, but not a uniform sampling grid. That was my point.
Randy Davis, WYES in New Orleans. The question I have, and something I noticed in your graph, that the close-in COFDMs seem to outperform or at least perform a lot better than at mid-range and farther out. And if that was based, if the failure on the COFDM was based on carrier to noise, the what was the failure mode for the 8VSB? And if that's the case, could it have been fixed by improving the power or increasing the power on the COFDM?
Well, it's hard to say definitively, but certainly the ability to operate in a environment of high multipath was worse for 8VSB than COFDM, largely impervious to, as long as you have enough signal level, multipath, if it's within the guard interval of COFDM, is not entirely, but somewhat irrelevant. It's not irrelevant at all in an 8VSB receiver that the ability to reject the multipath is a direct function of the adaptive equalizer that's implemented within it. So probably multipath is certainly one of the dominant characteristics of failure for the 8VSB, the 8VSB receiver. That's where manufacturers are certainly focusing their attention in large part to having better multipath rejection. In a field test, you can generalize and say, well, we know the carrier-to-noise ratio performance was different. We know the multipath mitigation was different. But in the field, there's a lot of other things combining there. The RF adjacent channel performance rejection was much better in the 8VSB receiver than the COFDM receiver. The ability to reject impulse noise was better in the 8VSB receiver. So you're kind of left with multipath as probably having at least a dominant role in the failures.
Joe Cordova, KLVX. Now, you tested at 6 foot, and I'm assuming that you were trying to get a line of sight type of test pattern, and you tested at 30 foot. Most of my experiences with rooftop antennas are at, say, 15 foot. Was there any unofficial testing done at those heights? There's not really many antennas at 30 feet.
Well, 30 feet is the standardized height that the FCC has used. That's the height of a two-story house mounted on the chimney, something like that. With all the tests we're doing, it would be nice to have data at intermediate heights. We did not do any of that. It was just 6 foot and 30 foot.
And the 6 foot was trying to keep clearance to your transmitter.
No, 6 foot was done in the same proximity, or just outside the truck. I suppose Greg could tell you exactly where it was, but it was the same location as the 30-foot measurement, which was, the pinpoint on the map. But you can't take the measurement if it's in the middle of a lake or a crosswalk.
Okay, thanks.
Lynn, Ron Valley from Spokane. Do you think the results of this study will have any influence on the rest of the countries around the world that have already decided on COFDM, on perhaps re-examining 8DSB?
It wasn't our intent to get into or to enter the international debate with this test. This was strictly to look at the U.S. situation, the U.S. environment, and see with the current state of implementation which system is better. Different countries have extremely different circumstances. If they're not going to implement digital television for a number of years, then they don't have to worry about what the current state of the art of implementation is. They can start looking at projection curves for what the ultimate performance, you know, a few years from now will be. We also have a really rugged environment here, and you know, stations all over the place, a lot of congestion, high power. Not many countries, if any, have megawatt facilities like the U.S. does. So I think you find that different circumstances obtain in different countries, and that the results of this test or of the U.S. environment may or may not be applicable to their, you know, to their certain situations. Certainly many countries use COFDM just on the flexibility issue alone, the ability to trade off data rate for ruggedness, to be able to implement a mobile service, even though you've cut the data rate in half. That's not been the capability within the ATSC system. It is, in, you know, probably in the future, and in fact, John Tollefson heads the specialist group that's working on finding out how feasible that is to implement within the ATSC system. But I think there are a number of different factors that other countries are looking at, and this is, you know, this testing is useful to them, but we certainly didn't intend to use it as a tool to deal with the international decisions that are being made.
Jan Pezrel, WXXR, Rochester, New York. You were doing comparison between NTSC and digital in Cleveland, correct?
Yeah.
NTSC is standard definition, one channel. Did you try to go DTV with, let's say, 3 to 4 megabits per second, standard definition, one channel? That would be sort of fair one-to-one comparison.
No, we didn't. But, of course, the ATSC stream is 19 megabits per second. There's no more error correction added to a 4 megabit per second data stream than there is to a 19 megabit per second data stream. It's just a lot more null packets if you're
doing. But COFDM have this capability to throttle down the bit rate and make it more robust and more bulletproof.
We did not do that. We did the comparison at the same data rate. Had we throttled down COFDM to 4 megabits per second and compared it with NTSC, obviously we would have had a much greater service area for COFDM. Equivalently, if you could do that for 8VSB, you would have a bigger service area for 8VSB or 4VSB or 2VSB or however you throttled down the data rate. But that flexibility, of course, is not currently in the ATSC standard as it is for COFDM, which is a big differentiator.